Hey, how's it going?
It's going all right. How's it going with you?
Not too bad, I guess. Back home. It's been a day. Had that math exam.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Well, we'll get to that for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, how are you? You said you weren't feeling too good today.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it.
Okay, fair enough.
It's fine. It's just physical. It's nothing terrible.
Okay.
Wait, so tell me about the Roderick on the Line thing. Let's start with that.
Yeah. Yeah, I texted Mike today, and it's weird. It's this uncanny thing. I don't know if it's probably just a coincidence that I'm reading into, but generally on Tuesdays I have class, and then I go home, and on the way home I listen to the latest Roderick on the Line, and then lately we've been recording on Tuesdays, so it's just sort of like this weird culmination of me listening to my favorite podcast, Roderick on the Line, which was sort of an inspiration for the show, and the content matter that they talk about is so often exactly what I wanted to talk about on the show, or if not what we're going to talk about in our show, what it is that I'm feeling in general. And it happens all the time. It's totally weird.
So what was it today?
Well, today it was just, it was anxiety in general. You know, I woke up this morning not feeling that great because I had that test. I took the test. I didn't feel particularly great about the test after I took the test. And then, when I was done with the test, I was basically already late for my next class. So I had to go because I had to schedule this appointment to take my test at the testing center, which was a new experience for me. They just basically put you in this little room, with these little study cubbies, and you just do your test there where you're under surveillance by cameras, and the doors are alarmed. I don't know. It's very, very strange. So yeah, I just felt super anxious about that, and I was late, so I'm like driving. I got cut off kind of by this woman. I had my signal to merge into this lane to go into a parking garage, and this lady just basically passed me, even though I had my thing going to the left. So she passed me on the left, and I nearly ran into her. She was going into the same parking garage that I was, and she actually parked a couple spaces away. So when I got out of the car, she's walking away from her car a couple steps ahead of me. And then she sprays her hair with hairspray, and I'm right behind her. And like, we're in a parking garage, so you know how they can be kind of like wind tunnels. The air is just getting sucked through there, and it blasts my face with this hairspray. So it's like in my eyes, it's in my mouth. Like, it's terrible. And
how old was this person?
She's probably a little older than me. Like, she's probably like
20s.
Yeah, late 20s. And not a single, like, I'm coughing, I'm sputtering, and I wanted to say something, but I was too late to get into an argument with somebody on the street. So I just kind of kept walking. And we basically walked into the building together. She opened the door and went inside, but didn't hold the door for anybody behind her. Like, she's completely in her own little world. And so, yeah, that all led up to going into class, where I was like late to, you know, take a bunch of notes that I probably really needed. And that led into accounting, which is like a super stressful class because it's so boring. And I can't seem to pay attention to what this woman is saying, but I need to, you know, to understand.
And seems very dry. Never taken an accounting class.
Yeah, it's exactly that. It's just so dry. It's impossible to pay attention because it's so uninteresting. And then when you realize that, like, the class is like, she's ready for us to do some sort of like class activity in our worksheet papers or whatever, it's like, oh crap. Like, I haven't been paying attention for the last 5 minutes. I'm just sitting here doodling. And I just felt anxious all day, just, you know, like sick to my stomach, anxious, probably mostly because of this test. And it just I never had a chance to like come down from that. So on the way home, I'm listening to my podcast, and Roderick on the Line comes on. And of course, like, they touch on this occasionally, but very rarely do they dive into their mental illnesses, as it were. And lately, apparently John Roderick has been dealing with a bunch of anxiety and like feeling like he's on the edge of a panic attack, like I've been all day. And it's just weird. It happens every single week. I'm synced up with them. And maybe that's because I've listened to over 300 episodes of their show, but I haven't been caught up with the most current of their episodes until, I guess, the past couple months. So, I don't know. It's weird. It's totally coincidental, and I know that. And, you know, I'm probably the reason that I like them so much is probably because we are so similar in so many ways or have very similar personalities. But it's just a weird thing that I seem to run into on most Tuesdays.
I feel like the most successful shows are the ones where you want to be friends with the hosts. Because there's plenty of shows I listen to where I just don't like the hosts, or I probably wouldn't want to hang out with you. But the ones that like you gravitate towards, like someone who you could just like listen to talk for hours, you would grab a beer with them. You'd, I don't know, like you'd want to see them lecture. Like you'd actively go seek them out at like a public speaking thing.
I used to think that was true until WWDC, when I met a bunch of podcasters that I always thought like, oh, it'd be really cool to like hang out and get a beer with those guys. And in some cases it is interesting, because I met Federico Fatici from Max Stories and a lot of Relay FM podcasts, and he was really cool. You know, we have very similar music interests and we're relatively the same age. Like, he seems to be the one that I would probably get along with the most. But I think the best part of that is he's so knowledgeable about stuff that I'm not. I'm attracted to people who know how to do things that I don't. And if he, you know, I feel like I get more out of a conversation if I'm learning something from somebody. So I feel like with people like him, maybe, yeah. But I was thinking about like, oh man, I'm here in San Francisco and this is where Merlin Mann lives. I don't know where in San Francisco he lives, and I don't know where I am in the city. I just know that I've been walking around the city all day. If I happen by some random chance to bump into Merlin Mann, how do I deal with that? You know, like I know how I should deal with that. And that's just to say like, hi, I'm a really big fan of your work. I've been listening to you for a long time. It's nice to meet you. And just kind of leave it at that. Like, say, I appreciate your stuff and carry on. But on the other hand, it's like, it is that weird thing where it's like, we have so much in common. You need to know about this. Let's be best friends. But you can't do that. Like, that's just how I would feel. So the entire time when I was over there, I was just thinking, God, I hope I don't run into him, because I don't know what I do. You know, like it's just one of those weird things. I don't get starstruck often. I used to work with a lot of people that would, you know, that were quote unquote famous. And I didn't really get that way because I'm like, oh, they're just people. But it's different with these podcasters who you listen to for so many hours. And especially with the ones that you really relate to, I don't think I could be friends with Merlin Mann. And I don't think that, I have no reason to believe that he would want to be friends with me. Like, I don't think that there's anything to that. But it is, I don't know, it's just a strange, strange phenomenon.
I think it's more the desire to want to hang out. Because I'm a firm believer in never meet your idols or kill your idols or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know if kill your idols a thing?
I have heard that said, but only during the Me Too era. I've seen that on Twitter. That is the thing.
Well, never meet your idols is kind of what I stand by. But I will say that it does sound fun to hang out. Like, feeling like it is going to be fun to hang out with somebody is not the same as like meeting that person and be like, oh, it actually, the person that you are on the microphone is not that cool. Or like the person that you are not on the microphone is not that cool.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to that. The person on the microphone is not surrounded by a bunch of people that they don't know. Like, it's a much different situation when you get into a social scenario with somebody that you've listened to when they're talking. Like, when we're talking on a podcast, we know that there's a potential of, you know, anybody listening to this show doesn't have that many listeners, but if it did, like, it has a ton of people that are hearing what we're saying, and in a way they're involved in the conversation. But it's not like that for you and I when we're sitting here talking. Like, I'm not talking to a whole bunch of people. I'm talking to you. And it's the same for any podcaster. You're sitting in a room, generally remote, probably by yourself, and you're talking to one or two of your close friends. So it's much different when you get into a social scenario where you have the opportunity to talk to this person, but of course they're not going to be exactly the same because they're talking to you a stranger that they've never talked to. And even though,
well, it's like, that idea of in-speak, though, it's that idea of in-speak again, where like you feel like you're part of the club but you're not, because you know all the inside jokes from the podcast.
Yeah And so like,
that's
what,
where it's
that is awkward, because it's like, okay, what do you say? You do meet a podcaster that you admire, like, and this is like the struggle that I had at WWDC. It's like, okay, I'm sitting right behind John Siracusa at this live event. Like, he's within 2 feet of me. Mm-hmm. I am staring at the back of his head. And I wasn't going to introduce myself, because I knew, it's like, what do I say? Like, do I make a funny reference to a thing you make? Do I, you know, try to stammer out, long time big fan. What ended up happening was my boss said, hey, John, because she doesn't listen to his stuff at all, but she knows who he is. And she's like, hey, John, this is Jacob. He's a big fan of yours. And I mean, in a way, I'm grateful, because that gave me an opportunity to say, hi, I really appreciate your work. Would you mind taking a photo? And we took a photo, which I never do. I never ask people to take a photo, but I didn't know what else to do. But on the other hand, it's like, God damn it. Like, it was enough that I had the story that I got to sit behind John Siracusa. You know what I mean? Like, I don't like these situations where I'm put in, where I don't know. Do I make a reference to your thing? Do I say, oh, how much I love your work? Like, how is that in any way like special and memorable? That's the thing. I think when you meet somebody that is notable in some way, you want them to remember you, or remember meeting you, because it's a special moment for you. You want it to be special for them as well. But there's really no way for that to happen, because you have nothing to go on. Like, there's no real icebreaker there unless you have something of interest to them. And I was lucky enough to have an event that I was kind of like pushing at the end of the week. It was like an after party for the whole WWDC thing that my company was sponsoring. But apart from that, like, what do you say? What do you get to say to these people? And yeah, it that's the thing. Like, we're part of the conversation, but really we're not. So yeah, in speak and all that jazz. I don't know. That's not really where I was going with this. It's just that, like, it's, have you ever felt so like in sync with somebody across many, many miles at the same time? Like, for, not just at one time, because yeah, like maybe you're bummed out and somebody else that you know far away is also bummed out, but so consistently?
No, I don't think I've ever been in close contact with somebody like that before. We're talking about like people that you know, or like strictly...
Well, I mean, with this podcast, like, I'm making a bigger deal of this than it really is, but it is just it's a strange little scenario where like I'll literally be in class not paying attention to accounting, and I'll be taking notes of all the things that maybe I want to talk about on the show later this evening, and then I get in the car and they are literally talking about the things that I wrote down that I want to talk about on my show, which makes me feel like, God damn it, like I feel like our show is going to be like a 5 week tape delay rehash of this other show that I listened to, because the topics are so similar.
Yeah, no, I get that. No, I mean, the only time I've ever been like that kind of in sync with something is usually like if I watch a movie or something like that, and then suddenly on all my podcast feeds, that star or the director or the writer of said thing that I watched or read, mm-hmm. or listened to is suddenly all over my feeds in every interview show, like just on multiple platforms. That's the only time. It's not so you're not so much in sync with a person as you're in sync with like the publicity circuit.
The press junket.
Yeah, exactly. Like just the stages of publicity. That's all. So short answer, no. I don't really feel connected to anybody in that respect.
No, we've been on that same train lately. The Nick Kroll, Chris Gethard train has been moving through our circles.
Well, now because we just we're trying to schedule Mike Birbiglia for next week.
Oh man, if you so get that, to do that one, I'll be so jealous.
I probably will. You know, we usually schedule around my schedule. Today we did Nikki Glaser. She was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's just super professional. And like the podcast we did was on her roast of Bruce Willis. And Jesse, you know, he's the senior editor for comedy at Vulture. So he's just all about asking the most technical details. Like, it's not, they don't ask like fluff questions or like life story questions like Maren, you know, like, mm-hmm. It's not about where she grew up. It's not about, you know, I don't even know what she would be asked on another podcast, but this one was like specifically like, so what was it like in like the green room, like leading up to the roast, and like, who did you sit next to at the roast, and how did you communicate with them, and what was the writing process? And she was so game to talk about every aspect of the writing process and unabashedly giving credit to people for the jokes that she said at the roast. And mm-hmm. that was just, it was really inspiring to hear that, I guess. Just,
it's
just real, you know, like you never really hear outside of, if you're standing in a circle of comedians, you might be hearing about joke writing. Mm-hmm. And you know not ghostwriting, but like just the people that you hire to help write you your jokes, and like most people don't even think about that. But Nikki was just like fully talking on a podcast about how she took submissions from multiple people, like random people that she'd just, you know, been referred to for jokes for the roast. And yeah, it's I don't know, it's nice to hear.
That's cool. No, I gotta dig into this podcast more. Obviously you've got Gethard on there, which I'm really looking forward to listening to, and that episode with Nick Kroll. But yeah, that sounds interesting. Like I love the anecdotal stuff. Like if it's like a deep personal anecdote, that's cool. Like Maren's great for that. But even in like my show, my retired show, like I would love those stories about like how that feature came to be. Like it's not always just like, oh, I think like Johnny Craig would be really good as a feature on this record. It's, you know, I was on Warped Tour and I ended up playing Magic the Gathering with this other dude from this other band, and that's how this and this clicked, and eventually that led to this side project. Like, I love that stuff because it's very natural, and it's also very natural to kind of like forget about how that came to be. But it's cool to like rehash that and think like, yeah, actually that's kind of, that's unique, and that's like noteworthy in some way.
It's, for me, the sausage being made is the most unique thing about it, or it's mm-hmm. the unique thing about it.
The writing, the actual
yeah,
writing
it's a,
process.
I mean, Jesse's described it as song exploder for jokes, and mm-hmm. This was one of the more specific episodes where we did that. Because Gethard, you know, we were talking about his past and everything, and like we did try and break down his jokes, or you know, Jesse tried to break down his jokes into segments and aspects and elements, and that was cool. But like a lot of it was his feelings on, you know, Louis C.K. or the Me Too movement or the Comedy Cellar, and not specifically the joke, which is important to be discussed on some podcast. You know, it's definitely, I think it's good that his opinions are heard because he has some pretty good ones. Mm-hmm. But knowing how the sausage is made was for me the best part of the whole thing, and just hearing, you know, like how somebody writes, and just the stuff that you don't get to see on the roast of Bruce Willis, and knowing that like somebody bombed really hard, but in editing they make it look like he did really well. And it's just, that's stuff you'll never know unless you listen to a podcast like this one.
Yeah. And I guess there's probably a lot of comedians that would rather not talk about that stuff or not talk about the process because they don't think it's like as sexy or interesting or gonna get them as many like sound bites.
Yeah, from what Jesse said, there's some comedians who are just like, yeah, I don't know, I just wrote it, and then they have to figure out something else to talk about. But there are some, like usually the young comics who are like super hard workers who haven't been in the business for, so you know, like 30 years, they're like, you know, the people like 15 years or less are really eager to just, you know, talk about the process, whereas the people who've been doing it for a long time are just jaded or don't give a shit.
Yeah, it's the thing. I guess when you're young blood, like that's new stuff to you. Like the process of like sitting down and writing with other people, that's a new thing. But when you've done that for a couple of decades, it's probably like, why are we talking about this? Like that's like 101, that's basics. Like, but not for anybody that doesn't do it. So it is interesting for a podcast, but I can see why that wouldn't be like a super popular thing for most comedians to talk about in most comedy podcasts.
And then right before we did good one. One of New York Magazine. New York Magazine is. Do you know The Cut?
Yeah,
I'm not. Yeah, so The Cut also has a podcast. I think they're part of New York Magazine. So they asked if they could interview Nikki for 15 minutes about pubic hair. And they so one of the reporters just pops her head in. She's a writer, and I think her name is Lisa. And she just pops in. She's like, "Hey, I'm just recording this thing." I was like, "Do you want to use our gear?" And she's like, "Okay, cool." So she sat down across from the table, and Nikki came in. And they introduced each other, or they got introduced, and we just started recording. We did 15 minutes just about Nikki Glaser and pubic hair, and like another unorthodox interview. But it also felt like she was kind of doing a stand-up routine for most of it. But I mean, it was an improvised one, 'cause there's no way that she had like that much material on pubic hair just prepared. I know she's like a sex comic is what they're, you know, making fun of. Like, it's like, why do women talk about their vaginas and then they become sex comics, but a man talks about their penis and then it's just, no, they're just a male comic, you know, it's right. Just normal.
Huh? Well, that's cool. Got another credit for your resume then.
I guess, but I don't think I'm going to get any credit on that one. That was just like, I hit record and then bounced all the files, sent it to the person, and they're never going to talk to me again. And that episode's going to go up, and
that's okay.
It
doesn't matter. You could still put it on your resume. Like, you don't have to. You don't have to have like an actual like person as a reference there. You don't have to put that down. But you can say, yeah, you have done editing work for The Cut.
Well, Nikki has a podcast. No, Nikki has a radio show on Sirius. So maybe now I can reapply to Sirius again and see if I can get on there.
Oh, yeah. There you go. That'd be cool. You want to work for is Stern on Sirius?
I interviewed at Stern last year. You? Yeah. I didn't get it. I really did well in the interview, but I think they wanted somebody with more radio experience.
I mean, that would be like that's a notable get, but I don't know. I don't think particularly highly of that show.
Yeah, it's Aaron's dad has been like a Stern listener for forever, probably since the beginning. And so every time I go upstate with Aaron's parents or something like that, and we're driving to or from upstate, it's just nothing but Howard Stern. And it's just, it's so vulgar.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
But it's like Aaron's parents, I'm just sitting there just like listening to these just raunchy things being talked about. I'm like, oh man, my mom would have changed the station so long ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I guess I'd prefer that to Glenn Beck in my dad's truck though.
Yeah, no, I would take that over Don Imus any day.
Oh God, Imus. Yeah.
Do you hear all that like bumping and thumping in like my room? Are you hearing all that?
No, what's going on?
It's not coming through the mic. Okay, so the heat turned on last night.
Ah.
That's how you know it's time for fall, dude. Not the leaves changing, not the things falling from the trees. It's the heat. Like, I woke up this morning. It was still dark, so it's probably like 4 or 5 a.m. I shut up because I heard and like thump, thump, thump. And like, okay, well, that's the heat going on in the apartment. Man. And it took me a second, though, because it just wakes you up out of your slumber. You're just like, holy.
Have you been there a year?
It's just right now, when
like,
that.
Have you heard that turn on for like the first time before?
Well, Aaron's been here 2 years, and I've been here November 1st. I'll have been here for a full year.
Okay.
And Aaron was here for a year beforehand. Huh. So she's, yeah. I mean, I've lived in New York for forever.
Right.
Seven. So, I mean, I know what the heaters sound like here, but in this apartment, no, I have not been here for day one of the heat. Hmm. But in other apartments, it is. I usually turned it off in other apartments when I had the option.
Yeah.
Some of them, like the last apartment I lived in, was just all you had was one pipe, just a solid pipe running floor to ceiling, and there's no off valve, there's no nothing, but that's where your heat comes from.
Oh man, what a weird.
And it was right next to my bed, so if I rolled over too far, I would like scald my face on a pipe. I never did it, but I slept on the outside of bed.
I mean, if your bed's near the heat, that's kind of nice.
But my bed was all. The thing is, it's a room. I think the room I did the dimensions. It might have been 8x10 room, and so
your bed had to be like there's.
Yeah, my bed was like, you know, 3/4 of that room, and so I'd have the heat on one side of it, but then right next to it would be the window, and so it'd just be, you know, if I rolled over one side, it'd be warmth, and then if I rolled over too far, the other side would be cold. So I just spend back and like just go back and forth between those two things. Hmm. I've only lived in one central air apartment here in New York City, and
that was pretty uncommon.
Yeah, I mean, some of the newer buildings have it.
Yeah.
But it was, yeah, definitely way more common, especially if you're doing free heat and hot water, you're going to be in a building with some old system. Mm-hmm. And that's what all that thumping is.
Yeah, it's treble season for podcasting. I'm going to have to deal with that pretty soon here, too. In fact,
treble?
Treble season? Oh, just trouble. Trouble with an O and a U.
Wait, what are you saying?
It's going to be hard for podcasting because of the various noises that our heater systems make.
Like, well, I think there's no good season for podcasting if you're not doing it in like a super controlled environment. Like if you're doing it it doesn't matter where I am. It's always terrible recording podcasts at every place I've ever been. It's either in my old apartment. If you listen to old episodes of Banthafly, you hear like tweet, 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 clink, 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 clink. Cause that was the one that was the heater. If you listen to any HeadGum podcast, you'll hear, cause we were on, like if you right outside the windows of the studio, because it was not like a conditioned studio or anything like that. If you right outside the windows was like a giant HVAC unit for the building next to us. So that was just blaring in every single one. Here we have either the AC, the fan, the heaters, the sirens, the helicopters.
I mean,
take your pick, man.
You're going to have to deal with the stuff. Like if you don't have central air and you have to have your window open, you're going to deal with the kids. You're going to deal with the dogs.
You're going to deal with the
lawnmowers. Like that all sucks. But in the wintertime, like my options are pretty slim. Like I can't, like with the configuration that I have my office in, I have my microphone here set up on a boom arm and that is attached here to my desk, and my desk is immediately under my heater vent for my office. So if I want to be warm during wintertime podcast recordings, I have to have that on until the minute that we're ready to record, then go turn it off. And I have to turn it off for the whole house because I can't just turn the vent off, because then you just hear as it's trying to get through the vent. I have to turn it off for the whole house, so my girlfriend freezes downstairs too. I don't know, like there's really no other option. Like I just have to deal with it. Like otherwise I have to find like another place to put my recording setup, and I don't know where to do that. There's really nowhere else, so it's just rough.
Yeah, I mean, living in a one-bedroom apartment, you kind of take what you have. And in this case, I have one bedroom to do this in.
Today when I got home, like what I meant to do was take the AC out of my window, because it's been cool enough here for the past couple of weeks that I really don't need it.
What floor are you on when you do that?
I'm on the uppermost floor, so the third floor. The
third floor, okay.
Yeah.
Aaron's lived on the sixth floor in most buildings, in the last two buildings we've been in. Mm-hmm. Together, so removing the ACs, you just fear, because, and I guess in the last, this building is not so bad because we have a fire escape out one window and then just the back, you know, where there's no backyard area at this building. Mm-hmm. So it's not worth, you know, you can't kill anybody here. But at the other place, it was all front facing street, sidewalk, mm-hmm. and stuff. So if you messed up taking that AC out, you're definitely going to kill a human being if you mess that one up.
Do you have like AC brackets on the outside of the building? Do they sit outside mostly?
They are required. We have it in one. I don't know if we have it in the other, but we have an internal mount. Like Aaron's dad's a superintendent, not for this building, somewhere else. So he came over to install the ACs like per to spec or regulation or whatever. So our second AC in the living room is it's bolted in.
Oh, cool. Mine is, it has no mount. It's just basically sitting in the frame, and then the window mm-hmm. closes on top of it, and that's what keeps it there, which makes taking it out alone really tricky, because I've got to, like, I basically just kind of have to, like, shimmy it, because if I can't really open up the window, otherwise there's nothing stopping it from falling through the lower roof.
We would tie the power cord to the radiator, which is right beneath the window, so we would just tie a knot with the power cord, and
clever, a little fail safe.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I don't know how it might be more failure than safety, but I don't know. It's just
belay on.
I can just, I mean, it may like change the trajectory of the AC as it falls out the window before it snaps the cord. Like, yeah, it gives it a bit, may be the only benefit.
It gives it some spin.
Maybe so it bounces against the wall and makes some noise as on the way down. That way somebody looks up and stops.
Oh, yeah.
Before they get clobbered by an AC unit.
Well, at least they'll know what happened. Yeah. So, yeah, it's a little chilly up here today. I should have taken it out, but instead I did Angry Dishes.
Angry Dishes?
Angry Dishes.
Like Angry Birds?
Sure. If Angry Birds is a stress reliever for you. When I get anxious, I like to occasionally clean things, and usually that means cleaning out the refrigerator of all the old bottles of ranch dressing and whatnot, and then doing the dishes and then taking out all the trash and recycling. That's what I did to calm down today while listening to the new
Pine Grove. Just being a productive human being.
Yeah.
Being helpful around the house. God, yeah. I'm so anxious. I just got to be helpful.
It just feels good to like get something done because you know you have all this other stuff to do. So in a way, it's kind of like procrastination, but this also needs done. And you know you're just not going to do it otherwise. And you're like, you know what? I don't want to do any more homework right now. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to do something where I can just like zone out. And I feel like dishes is a really good thing for that. I gave up on the podcast this afternoon because I just wasn't in the mood to talk to anybody or have anybody talk to me. I just put on some music that I could sing along to and enjoyed the soapy suds.
Wow. Yeah. I'm backsliding. I can't stop listening to podcasts I don't want to listen to.
Oh, yeah. That was one of our follow-up items. Like, at the end of last episode, you realized that we didn't really talk about, like, slipping behind on things and how that tied into our greater conversation from last week.
Mm-hmm.
You were talking about like slipping behind on comics and YouTube and like what was all that?
Oh, well, I think we were talking about what if I slip behind and the podcast thing is a constant slipping behind, you know, like I'm still listening to last weekend's podcasts. I think This American Life comes out on Sunday evenings and that's what I'm on now. And it's Wednesday. So I got Monday, Tuesday to deal with. Is it Wednesday? No, it's Tuesday now. Dude, I don't even know what day it is anymore.
Yeah, no, I've still got I started This American Life on the way home.
That's not an upper.
It is not an upper. Good episode, no. Though. I mean, it's interesting in its own way. But
it's a fantastic episode. It's captivating and riveting, but yeah. We're talking about the school shooting episode.
Yeah, that's why I had to turn off the podcast. That was the last one I was listening to before I shut it down. I'm like, okay, I need a break.
Yeah.
I don't feel very great, yeah. And this is not helping out. But
no. What'd you listen to?
Music-wise?
Yeah.
I've been listening to the Pine Grove record a lot. It's a very calming album.
Yeah, I guess calming, if you're looking to distract yourself. I'd listen to it once, and then Intrepid's the only thing I've liked off of it. Besides, you know, I think Angelina's on there, right?
Yeah. They reused it as they want to do. But I think it takes a couple listens. The first time through, I was like, okay, this is Pine Grove, but it seems like this is all the filler I would have expected from their follow-up record.
Mm-hmm.
But after listening to it a couple times, man, this album's really great. Like Rings, Intrepid, and Skylight, like they're jams.
I'll try it again. Yeah, I think I was expecting something more, mm-hmm. like more bangers.
Yeah,
I guess.
Me too.
I say bangers, but I mean like Pine Grove bangers. You know, like
well, you know, dancey stuff.
Yeah. I think that's what. What was their first record called, their debut? What was that? Holy shit, why can't I remember it? Pine Grove
Cardinal?
It wasn't just Pine Grove Cardinal. Yeah. Cardinal, yeah, holy shit. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Cardinal, I just felt like there was more I could get behind in that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I should just not talk about it because I've only listened to it once.
Yeah. I feel like it's really
it didn't hook me, you know. There weren't as many hooks. There wasn't like Old Friends. It's just, you know, from the second you hear that stuff, you're just kind of like Like when it was Leah on the bus a few months ago, saw some old friends at her funeral, like that's such a good line. And like from the moment, like even if you can make it, you know, 3 minutes into the song to get to that line, you're just like, oh damn.
Yeah.
I will love this song every time I hear it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, Cadmium and everything on that record is pretty great.
No, I agree. I don't think there's really like a skipper on that record. And that's what
I don't like Waveform that much. Waveform is not a big one for me.
I guess if there were to be a skipper, that would be it. But I don't know. I let it play through.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if it comes on shuffle, I'll probably skip it if I'm listening. But if I'm going for a full listen of the album, there's nothing I want to change.
Yeah. I still, every time I finish this album, and I've listened to it probably like a dozen times now, like it's a really good album to work to. Like, you know, I'm learning the lyrics as I go, and sometimes I generally do this by listening passively in the background. But it's so short. This new record's 30 minutes long. It's, I mean,
nine songs, right?
11 songs in 30 minutes.
Oh, 11 songs. Damn.
Yeah. I mean, the average run length is really, really short. So every time I get to the end of it, I'm like, oh man, like I still want more. Like there's still more to this record that I was expecting, but the songs are really thoughtful. They're maybe not quite as catchy. There's not as many hooks, but
yeah, I think if you're a lyrics person, then it's definitely gonna make more of an impact. But if you're a type of person like me who just hears only the music and the hooks and maybe catches the lyrics on, like, you know, the fifth or sixth pass, you finally realize, oh, that's what they're saying.
That's interesting to me because you're a very lyrical writer.
Lyrics are the last thing I do. I almost never
really.
Like, lyrics are the bane of my existence, man.
Really? Because
everything,
I mean, that's
is music
what,
and
that's
melodies.
What caught me for your stuff. Like, obviously, I love your music, and it's always, like, super solid, and I can't believe this is all, like, I can't believe that this isn't, like, a full band when I hear it, but your
well,
lyrics are
thoughtless.
What always caught me.
My lyrics aren't thoughtless, but they're definitely, they're a labor, and they're difficult, but just, I mean, because I don't hear lyrics doesn't mean that I don't put effort into writing them either.
Yeah.
It's
yeah, that's just interesting to hear. I guess I've never like really gone through your process before. Like, you've always like kind of kept me up to date on the on like your goals for the last record, but I didn't really know like how that worked for you. That's interesting.
Yeah, we could do a song exploder sometime.
I still think, man, I've recently heard that another band has already done this, of course, but I think it would be really cool to do just like a short podcast, just kind of like going behind your record and talking about the new one when you decide to put it out. I think it'd be cool to just talk about the whole thing.
Yeah. The demos aren't even that different from the final ones. So it's just like, I could just use all the demos for the stems. Mm-hmm. Or I could ask Steve.
I think
for
you should.
The stems.
I mean, if I were you, like, here, my thought is this, like, you've always been very adamant about keeping control of your masters, like, your records are yours. I totally, like, I've always understood that and totally respect it. But if the masters are mine, I would want the stems for that. I mean, how long are you keeping Logic files and you don't have the stems for your own record?
Yeah, I guess that's, I mean, Steve's not keeping it from me, and he's not like the owner of the masters. He's just his hard drive.
Yeah, I know that, but if it were me, I would just feel like I need to also have those on my hard drive. Like, I need to have a backup of that, and then I need to have a backup of my
I guess it's
backup.
Like a... I'm like a dog chasing cars, Jake. You know, I wouldn't know what to do with it if I had it.
You don't have to do anything. It's just nice to know that it's there. Like this Chewbacca head that I have sitting on my...
God, my I don't want to talk about that. See, by the Father, episode 9 or whatever it is for that.
Yeah. No, I get it.
Dismembered Chewbacca cool head.
And it would make it easier for us to do a podcast, so I would say get him.
I just, oh man, I can, yeah, no, I'll email him tomorrow and just see what he wants to do. But yeah, holy shit. I have the stems for the first record. You gonna do a song exploder for the first EP?
Dude, we totally could. That would be so cool.
It would, you know what? I think Fire came on the other day on my shuffle. Mm-hmm. Well, I was just like, you know, reading something or, you know, reading the news at work, and I listened to every song in my library on shuffle, and like a dumbass, I don't have my music unchecked from shuffle, and Fire came on, and I listened to the whole thing through. You know, that Erica came out in 2012, so that's 6 years separation from that record.
That EP holds up.
It is, you know, like as much as I shit on the analog process, you know, and like, and idolizing or glamorizing the analog process, that record does sound really awesome for that reason, for that whole analog thing. And I remember when the mixer, the guy Zach McNeese, who mixed the record, who works on West Wing Weekly, actually now he does that, and he does some song exploder stuff.
Everybody's pivoting. Everybody's going podcast.
It is. No, I mean, me and Zach talked about that years ago when I, yeah, anyway, so he was just listening to it and he's just like, oh man, these tracks sound so goddamn good. And then I told him about the process of recording, and I think we never talked about that publicly before, but if we ever do, it's a long story. Maybe we'll save that for a different episode. But yeah, after Zach heard about how awful the process of recording that record was, he was like, those tracks sound so fucking amazing. It's too bad that I would literally never recommend anyone ever record at that studio because of that experience of yours, you know? And that's what happens. Like, you know,
yeah,
it sucks that it sounds so good, but it was such a terrible process.
There's an analog studio in Ohio I can recommend. One of my old college professors has a studio in Athens.
So. Oh, man. I don't think I would do analog again unless I had a full band.
Yeah.
I think that's the only way I would ever. Because it's just like, you know, tracking independently. First of all, nailing a drummer down was insane. To like booking a drummer time and having to cut all the drum tracks in 1 or 2 days. I think it was just one day.
Who did percussion on that record?
This guy named Craig Sala, who plays drums for a band called Paranoid Social Club. But yeah, he's just like a really solid drummer. He came in and learned the tunes. I don't even know that he had ever heard them before. He might have listened to the demos once in like an email, like, but he literally came into the studio and just played the songs, and we ran them through. Probably, I mean, we spent 8 hours, I think, in one day doing drum tracks, so we probably just did them all a few times through. And you know, he didn't nail it. There's a lot of stuff on that. Like, if you listen to that record, you'll hear a person who's never heard the song before playing drums. You might be okay with it, you know. It might be lined up, you know. I think Zach did a lot of, he put everything onto a grid and mapped it out, and he did some, what was his, Drumagogue. He added some, you know, drum samples in there to beef the drums up a little bit and make them sound a little more confident. But if you listen to the raw stems on that, it's just not, you know, it's the sound of a person who's just coming in and kind of just phoning it in. But he's so good that it's okay, you know?
Yeah.
You listen to that song Exploder with, is it John Roderick from The Long Winters?
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that one up. That's exactly the one I was thinking about.
Well, because that's the one where he talks about it. That's the one everyone talks about, Song Exploder. They talk about that one because that's the one that, like, you're walking down the street, you'll just be sobbing while listening to it because of the process. But I can't remember the name of the drummer for that.
I've heard it a million times and I can't either. I have a feeling, I think it's Chris. Isn't it Chris something? I could be wrong.
I have no idea. But that episode describes the drummer coming in, and the perception of Roderick was that the drummer was just coming in and, you know, like, well, we got this guy, he's a really great drummer, to come in and drum. And he just kind of like bumbled through the song and did like 5 takes of it, and then came into the control room and said, okay, pan the first take to the left, pan the second take to like 3/4 of the way to the left, and then pan the third take to the center, pan the just so on through each track, panning it over the 180 degree spectrum. And you know, it all, then you find out that over the course of him bumbling through this song, he's just been constructing all these weird fills that are just coming in on each side and in stereo. And so it was like a masterfully orchestrated drum track. Definitely not what happened on the first Old Best Friend EP. Anything cool about that record is totally accidental or terrible. Those are the only possibilities for that record. Nothing was intentional. Except for one hit and things that happen. And that was it.
I absolutely love that first EP of yours. And I think, like, yeah, it does really hold up. It's really good to listen to all the time, even today. And that song, Fire, that you were talking about earlier, like, that song is so weird and so good. Like, it gets caught in your head with nothing. Like, it takes nothing. It's just in your head. And now it's in my head, and it will be in my head probably for the next couple hours at least. And, yeah, it's just weird because it's not like a, it doesn't sound typical at all in any way. It sounds like a, you know, like a song that you're, it feels like I'm on top of a horse when I'm listening to that song. And well, I mean, never explained anything.
Yeah, it's just a shuffle beat, you know?
But you don't hear that on anything. And like, I'm always surprised when I hear a waltz. Like, there's a waltz on the new Pinegrove record, and I'm just, whenever I hear a waltz, I'm just like, well, that's like, it's so old that it's fresh because nobody else is doing anything like that. That was one of the reasons I was like, man, okay, this old best friend thing, I'm getting down with this. Who's this guy?
Yeah, man, that song took a lot of like weird turns when I finally tried to make it live. We tried playing it in Ohio when you were there. That didn't go well. But then, because that was like Eric's first time playing the song ever. But before that, my first drummer, the first live iteration of Old Best Friend, like there was this one dude who just, the guy Russ who played drums, he was so into making these songs like arranging them for a live version. And it struck me how interested he was in making them really good live. And Fire was really fun because we just like took huge liberties with it, and it never saw the light of day. We never played it live ever, but we definitely made it sound good in the rehearsal room. There might be a drum, like a voice memo track somewhere that sounds terrible.
I think you've got a lot of this together, but you need to make sure you have all of that together, so when we start doing this series, we've got all that ready to go. You've heard the old ones, right? The Mike Birbiglia podcast, where he kind of like goes over his old old one man shows and kind of talks through them. It was initially like a promo for his new one called The New One.
Oh yeah, I've never listened to that, but I remember Jesse was talking about it because we have Good One and Mike Birbiglia has The New Ones, and so we just we say, yeah, so we have to have a ones podcast.
I love that idea. It's a really good show because he brings in somebody that was like in some way relevant to that particular special. So whether it be, you know, like Nick Kroll was a guest, John Mulaney's been a guest, his brother was a guest, Ira Glass, I think, was in on the first episode. Like people that have been part of his creative process come in and they talk about not only that particular special, but also the guest special and like what they were doing around that time, how they met and all that stuff. I think that retrospective kind of thing is really interesting, and it was a great lead up to his new special, because obviously Mike Birbiglia is a very story driven comedian. His stuff's really funny, but more than anything, he's a storyteller, and having that context of all of these other specials, even if you've never heard them before, made the new one even more special. I think something like that for music is really cool. I wish more bands would dive into their records like that and do like behind the scenes things, whether at the time of recording or afterwards, because I think retrospectives are really interesting too. And I like when bands do that, especially if they go beyond the rank your albums listicle sort of format.
Unless you're having like a documentary crew come in and take care of it for you, like the label will hire one of those people, like people to come in with a camera and film the whole process or whatever. Like it's like, I think of like the Blink-182 videos for the self-titled album, that guy Cheetah. I don't really know what his relation was to the band, but they like Cheetah vids every week to document the recording process, and that was really cool. But there's no way that any of those dudes in that band had the energy to hold a camera and talk to it any farther than stealing the camera from Cheetah and you know, just going on a rant or like jumping on the trampoline or something during a break. There's no downtime. I mean, I'll change that. There's so much downtime in the studio, but most of it is just beating your head against a wall because you're trying to wait for what your bandmate to come up with the right thing or do the right thing on a take. And none of that time you want to be spent like just being like, okay, so like what we're thinking here is this, and we're gonna try and do this here, blah blah blah.
Yeah, I mean, you're not,
or like
you're not
trying to hold
a
camera.
Like I don't think there's really been.
Like diarying after the studio, like I took really detailed studio notes, you know, while we were recording both of my records, both full lengths with Steve. You know, I have like all the gear we used on every single song. I have that recorded and like certain techniques we used. You know, but that's just like, you know, scribbling down on a sheet really quickly just in case we have to come back to it in the next day, or in case I want to know if somebody asked me like, oh man, what amp did you use in that album?
Or in case Michael, you record actually, a podcast in 6 years.
Yeah, in case I record a podcast in 6 years. The first EP, I have no idea. I could probably remember from off the top of my head, but it was really boring.
Well, no, I like that Coheed does that for, I don't know if they've done it for all their records, but they've definitely done it for the past few where they, you know, they do sort of like a documentary behind the scenes sort of thing. It's usually not that long, but it's something, and that's cool. But I think that's neat. I mean, it's something you can look back on because, yeah, you've got this like finished piece that you can hold up as something that you made, and that's special. But I think, you know, seeing how the sausage is made is something that interests you, and it interests me too. And if like a band can somehow manage to do that, whether it be like at the time or taking notes and kind of rehashing it later, like I think there's something to that. And I think that that's probably special for anybody that is a fan, but I think it could also make somebody who's coming into your work already feel like they're involved because they're so like, you can bring them in. You can show them the whole process. Say like, this is exactly how it went. And maybe that'll be different in some way that they weren't expecting because they're like, okay, old best friend, what is this? Sounds like New Best Friend, which was a band from Michigan. It's probably sounds like that. It's probably like indie or pop punk or something. And they listen to a couple tracks and like, okay, yeah, it's good. But you know, what's going to make them like cling on if they're not like really listening to the musicality or the lyrics or whatever it is that normally grabs them, if they're just kind of like listening to it dismissively, what's going to make them grab on? But I think something not gimmicky, but something exclusive, something bonus on top of that could really drive it home and say, okay, like this is how I can see like what makes this special. And I think that could work for any band. But not every band takes notes, and not every band has the capability or the desire to rehash their old stuff. But I don't know. It's something to think about. I think it would be cool.
I'll do it, but I won't make it. As long as I can make the episodes not longer than 10 minutes, then I'd be down. I couldn't bear to listen to a podcast or work on a podcast about myself that's longer than 10 minutes.
Yeah,
that doesn't, you know, tell a story, you know, like if it's just like an analytic podcast, 10 minutes on myself and then the song, that's it, in and out.
You know, there are probably some songs that don't even need rehashing, like unless there's something to say about it, like there's no reason to talk about it at all. But if, you know, that isn't to say that there could be one song that deserves its own episode, but you could probably roll a couple into another one, or you could explain, you know, like a more broad concept, or just talk about the studio itself in one episode. I mean, it's your thing. You pick the format.
Yeah.
So you went Apple picking.
Be interested to hear the. Oh yeah. Yeah. I did, because it's fall, dude. You got to go Apple picking.
Yeah. I went last weekend or 2 weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's good times.
You get some apples?
Yeah, pick some apples.
We went for this more for the distillery. There was a cider place right there, and there was also, they had like some craft beers on tap too, so that was my main incentive for going, and like the apple picking was just a side thing. And now I have like 40 apples just sitting on my counter that I really don't know what to do with, because I stopped eating Same. Apples after they started hurting my freaking gums.
Oh yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah, I think I'm going to try to make some applesauce or something. Maybe I like sautéing them up with like cinnamon, making, you know, like little fried apples. That's good stuff.
There's talks of an apple pie in my house right now.
Who's talking about it? And is it actually going to get done?
It's really just talk right now. We're discussing it. We've confirmed today that we will need brown sugar for said pie. So that's going to be a first step, is coordinating a trip to the grocery store in which one of us purchases brown sugar.
Now is this gonna be lettuce topped or, you know, like Dutch? Or
I think Dutch is the, where it's just the crust on top, right?
That's right. It's like,
it's
the
just like a flat
top
thing with like a bunch of little holes. This just like a little, what, crumbly? Oh no, I don't think I'm not gonna Dutch that. No, I'm a much more traditional apple pie, like just crust on the bottom and then crust layered over the top. I like the lattice is just a little too much effort for my, you know, it's like, it's going to be devoured. I don't need this thing to look nice. I'm also a huge fan of crust. No, that's the braid. I don't know. The braid is just too much. Like, this thing is going to be in my belly and it's going to be mush. So why do I need to make this thing look pretty? I'm not entering it in any contests. Just, I need it to be full of apples and sugar. And the gram will look great regardless. I mean, no, you know what? The gram will look terrible because it's my kitchen regardless. So did a full 180 on that one. I was going to say it'll look great because it's a pie, but then I remembered my kitchen and what food pictures look like in my kitchen, and it's just, it's not great.
Didn't you say you got like a new cutting board? Just put it on the cutting board. It'll look great.
Oh, yeah, that's the cutting board. We don't have a new cutting board. We have an old, like, two-year-old cutting board, and I'm sure there's plenty of diseases just lurking in that wooden thing that I clean.
Yeah, it's hard to clean wood. The wooden spoons, like, they're just disgusting.
No, we had this talk last week or something.
I think we did.
I'm a fan of wood utensils all the way through. They biodegrade, right? So, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, eventually. Everything does, eventually, mostly.
I mean, yeah, maybe plastic in a couple hundred years, a thousand years. Yeah. Oh, God,
My orchard also just opened a distillery, which was kind of a surprise to me. I thought it was just like a winery. I thought maybe they were just, you know, picking up wine, but yeah, it's like a full thing. It's pretty cool. They had like maybe 10 or 12 different kinds of cider on tap.
I think it's the realization that there is a market for craft beer and craft cider now, and that the apple picking season probably runs 2 months, you know, like Labor Day to end of October is probably, you know, before everything starts dying for the winter. So, you know, a 2 month season of, you know, like packed weekends. Cause like, I mean, this apple picking place is probably packed daily. You know, we went on a Saturday and you know, the parking lot was full. It was like a one in, one out kind of thing for the parking lot or one out, one in. And, like it just wasn't, you know, I mean, that's great for 2 months, but if you want to have a great business model for the rest of the year, why not have a distillery that can just brew all year? I mean, granted the apples may be harder to come by, but I think I have no idea what the brewing process is like. So I don't know if you can store apples for a while or, you know, I don't know how it works.
Well, I think they're probably making it in bulk ahead of time.
Yeah,
like you can keep the kegs, or if you know if they're doing it in barrels, which in some cases I think they do, you can just barrel it up, and it's going to take a while anyway. So, in most cases, distilleries aren't open for at least the first year, sometimes first 2 years of business. Like they'll have the property set up and everything, but they've got nothing to show for it for a while because they're brewing. Beer goes a little bit quicker, but if you're doing like hard liquors or in some cases ciders and wines, it takes a little bit longer.
It's like 2 years before you can even sell your product. It's crazy. It's like, crazy. It's like my album or something, you know?
Yeah.
Right, what about pumpkin picking? Did you do any pumpkin picking?
No, you know, that's one of those like aspirational things. It's like, oh, it's fall, better plan to go pick some pumpkins. But then like whenever we have a free weekend and then we drive by the place that people go to pick pumpkins, it's packed. And it's just like, I don't want to deal with that. Like that's just, we could also just buy pumpkins down at the store. Like they're not going to look any different than the ones that we get out of the patch. Like I think
just like really heavy.
Yeah. They're heavy and you got to lug them all the way across and you can't carry them by the stem because the stem might break off and then it won't be as cool. Like, I don't know. There's something to it. And I used to grow pumpkins and that was fun, but, I don't know. I'm not.
Did you grow a 2,000-pound pumpkin?
No. Did you see that tweet?
Yeah, the one that was like the race for the 2,000-pound pumpkin.
Yeah, like the competitive pumpkin growing in Canada that they have, which is super interesting because it's like their prize-winning pumpkins are smaller than American prize-winning pumpkins by like hundreds, if not thousands, of pounds.
America.
But that's because they have like, they have more regulations on how to grow stuff up there. So
yeah,
it's,
like
it's
you
actually
can't
like,
give your pumpkin steroids in Canada. Yeah. While in America, you can give it like growth hormone, pumpkin growth hormone, PGH.
Yeah. I think that actually makes it more interesting. Like I was more interested to read about the Canadian process than like I have friends here that do competitive growing. And it's like, okay, yeah. Like I can expect to see a gigantic pumpkin at the fair every year, which is kind of neat. Like, I mean, it's a freak thing. Like there's no reason why any sort of gourd should be that large, but it is cool.
Can you like, there's no purpose to it, right? You don't do anything with it. It just kind of rots, right? You can't make a pie out of it. Can you? You can't carve it. It's like falling over on itself. It's like, it's a horrible thing. It's like a, you know, like the farms that just like, you know, gorge the pigs or the cows or whatever, you know, just like, it's just a horrible thing that's happening.
Yeah.
poor pumpkins. The poor pumpkins.
Yeah. I don't know. Actually, that's a really good question. I don't know if you can actually do anything with it. I would hope that you could, but I think at the same time, those are the kinds of gourds that are just grown for show, and they're going to sit out for show.
Decorative gourd season, motherfuckers.
Yeah, I mean, okay, you grow a 1,000-pound pumpkin, you're going to want to show that off for a while. There's no reason to break it up. Like, it's going to sit there until it's no longer good for anything. So maybe there is, like, a certain amount of time where you could use it for a whole lot of pumpkin pies or rolls or whatever. But I don't think probably any of them get used for that purpose, because they're at the state fair and then they move to the other fair. And
yeah, we didn't even make the effort to pumpkin pick last weekend. We just kind of, you know, moseyed like onto the orchard. Like, it was so muddy too. It was raining all morning. So we got there and we were all like, there were so many tourists there from, you know, I mean, they could have been city folk too. Like, I'm a city folk now, I guess, but you know, I grew up in apple picking country, and Erin grew up in apple picking country, and we live in the city now, but we go up on the weekend to visit her parents and pick apples. But there were so many people who did not grow up around that just showed up in vans and jeans and whatever, you know, just like, not sandals, not necessarily that bad, but just, you know, white. There's a dude in like white Ultra Boosts that was just there, and those are like $250 sneakers, and it was the rainiest, muddiest day, and I was like, what are you thinking, man? You're going to a farm in boots or in shoes that cost $250 and are white, you know, like, you can't, you're not coming back the same as you went in, buddy. Erin have our like our waterproof Timberlands that you can hose down after the fact.
And you're wearing your Patagonias and
my Patagucci.
Yeah.
How heavy? No, I was wearing my Summit Ice, which Nikki Glazer commented on today.
Oh, cool.
No, because Erin got me a Summit Ice. You know what Summit Ice is?
No, absolutely not. What is this?
Okay, so Summit Ice is the brand Nathan Fielder from Nathan For You.
Oh, shit. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, so Erin bought me one of those last year for either my birthday or for Christmas. She bought me a zip-up, you know, a puller, whatever it's called. And, you know, I typically wear it every day in the winter, and or every day that justifies, you know, a lighter zip up, and nobody ever says anything about it. But of course, it's hanging on a chair when Nikki walks in, and she goes, "Who's Summit Ice is that?" And like, because you probably met Nathan, and like, there's like a post online of just a million famous comedians wearing their Summit Ice jackets. I was like, "Oh, it's mine."
I didn't know that he actually. I didn't know these were legitimately for sale. I'm looking now. Oh, this is incredible.
Did you see the episode where he donated like a ridiculous amount of money to like the Holocaust Museum?
I haven't made it that far. I think I'm still in like season two, maybe three.
It's so good. Every episode of that is gold. But
I mean, it's the funniest show I've literally ever seen in my life. I've never laughed that hard at anything before.
Erin and I have to hide ourselves, and when we're watching it, like, we get really like the cringe is so real. It's so real. But it's a lighthearted cringe. It's not a mean-hearted cringe. Like, I would say 99% of the time, it's a nice cringe, like it's at nobody's real expense. Everybody's like a willing participant, and it's mostly at Nathan's expense.
Yeah, but it's great because, you know, like, there's so much forethought that goes into exactly what he says to produce that cringe. And then that he isn't breaking is just makes it all that more funny. Like, because like, there's no way that you could ever do that. You can't do that. He's a freak in that way. Like, there's just nobody else that can do what he does. It's super special. But oh my god, this website is hilarious. It's just up top.
Yeah, it's real.
It looks totally normal all the way through the fold, and then you see like the soft shell technology where they have like a tear down with arrows and moisture, and it shows all the wicking and everything. And then right next to it, it says the Holocaust.
The Holocaust.
It's just like, oh my god, 6 million Jews died.
This is Cameron model.
This is amazing.
What jacket do they is wow, that's a nice jacket. It's the one I have, the soft shell.
Is it
Summit
good?
Ice
is it
soft
actually
shell jacket. It's fine. Yeah, I mean, I was sweating today, and it was like, you know, high of 59 today, I think, in New York City. And I was sweating, like I was too hot.
Who actually produces these?
So he gave all the proceeds. All proceeds went to the Holocaust Memorial. Or the Holocaust Museum. And they're like, this is a ridiculously amazing donation. And he like went and had to do that. It was so great. Oh, they have beanies too. That's kind of nice. I think I want a toque.
Jack Black has some.
Everybody's got them. If you just Google like celebrities with Summit Ice,
no, there's a gallery. It has them all right here. Alexander Daddario.
But it's only Jack. Oh, you have John to click Mayer. On it. I was looking at it. It was like, I wonder if Nikki will be in that.
Oh my gosh!
Wait, these are all people from the roast. I feel like he just went to a roast and kind of just handed these things out.
Oh really?
Yeah. That's I don't really know because I know because if Nikki has one and Joseph Gordon-Levitt has one, they were both at that roast of Bruce Willis. But this is also way before that. The Rob Lowe roast, that was a big one. Mm-hmm. Rob Lowe's in brilliant. The picture. Okay, of course.
Incredible. No, I kind of want one.
I bet it's. I mean, it's a nice soft shell. It's,
at least the T-shirt.
It's warm.
Or the beanie.
It's quality.
Ooh, sick.
Yep, it's good stuff. I wonder what their news.
Somebody tweeted today that they were sitting behind Nathan Fielder on an airplane. And they asked him if the show is coming back, and he confirmed that it is not. He's done with it, but he's working on some other stuff.
Oh, that sucks.
It does suck.
That's a huge bummer.
But you know what? Go out on top.
It must have been really hard for him to
make. I love when a show knows when to quit, and I don't think he ever had a bad episode, so why not go out?
Yeah, I can't imagine. It must have been hell to produce that.
Yeah,
just the amount of coordination and the detail that went into every bit.
Mm-hmm.
Like thinking of those bits, you know, he has to like think of a way to subvert something.
Mm-hmm.
And legally, he like exploits every system available to him.
Yeah, but it's so clever. Like when I was watching through the first season, and this is years after it passed, you know, the episode where he had like the pig save the goat or something.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that the original video that was uploaded on the fake account is still there. Like, it's still, you can still go find that, and you can find all the news stories from, like, the local news channels when they were talking about it. Like, you can, because at first I was like, okay, this show is really funny, but there's no way this is true. There's no way that this is actually happening. But that was, like, the first sign that I was able to find on my own. It's like, oh my gosh, like, this was actually a thing. It's pretty incredible.
What was the movement thing that have you seen the episode about the movement or whatever, like where you're moving things to get a good workout?
No.
Okay, well that's coming up. It's like
that's a newer one.
The bodybuilding one. Yeah. You'll see that one soon. But that was something I saw on the news before it happened.
Uh-huh. A couple of years ago, let's see, when was this? A couple of months ago, I started watching these older videos, like pre-Nathan For You. He kind of did these segments for a Canadian TV station called Nathan On Your Side. And if you have not seen these, you need to go watch them because it's like early prototypes for what would become his show. But they're so incredibly funny. It's a lot of on-the-street stuff, but it's so good.
I imagine just like a lower budget Nathan For You.
Yeah, but it's still, I mean, it's perfect. Like when you're watching Nathan For You, it doesn't seem high budget. Like, okay,
it doesn't until you factor in all the things that they have to do.
Right.
Like the yeah. rentals, like the mansions that they have to rent for that dating episode. all the 20 people they have to hire to. Or,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah. But so just good. Watch any of those and then go back through his actual YouTube channel. Because there's a bunch of really good old gems on there. Man, he's brilliant. He's incredible
example of bad cringe. Who is America? Like I am cringing so hard in that show.
Yeah,
because of how awful things he's highlighting, you know. It's like it's just weird because it's the same. It's a cringe thing where you're feeling terrible about what's happening, but it's so heavy-hearted because it's you're cringing because of how embarrassed you are about a part of America that sucks.
Yeah.
And with Nathan For You, it's like, you're cringing because like, it's really silly that Nathan's, you know, telling this girl he loves her or making this girl say, I love you to him over and over again. You know, it's like,
yeah,
God, that was so good.
Yeah.
But it's just like, who is America? I just can't. I Aaron and I have watched probably like 4 or 5 episodes and just had to stop because it was like too depressing
mm-hmm.
to see how awful people are.
Yeah. I'm glad the run was as short as it was. I watched through all of them, but I felt the same. I mean, I don't think anybody who's actually going to watch that thinking that it's going to be entertaining. I don't think anybody's going into that thinking anything different. You know what I mean? Like you kind of know what you're getting with this stuff.
Well, that's, I think that's why all the guests, like, they didn't really have to go. I mean, there was one, the one dude who had to, like, just, you know, step down from whatever he does.
A couple of them did, but
I'm sure there's been a few, I'm sure there's a few people that had to step down, but, yeah. But, like, most of the bigger people that he interviewed that are, like, are pretty, you know, well-established in the political world, like, they didn't have to go too hard on the defensive, because I think they know that their what do you call them, fan base, or, like, is it a senator? Like, their people, mm-hmm. their constituents, like, they're not going to watch that. So, yeah. Who are they apologizing to? Just the people that watch Who Is America, who they don't really care about because they're not getting their vote anyway. So.
Well, also, and any of them that did, or you know, of course, like, a lot of people, even if they're not watching his show, are going to hear about it. Like, the point of this show is that it's going to get picked up on a lot of, you know, media outlets saying, you know, like, guess who Sacha Baron Cohen duped this week?
Yeah.
They're going to read that, but at the same time, who cares? These people generally aren't going to really give a shit. If anything, they're just going to use this to get more angry at, you know, the liberal media for trying to make them seem like they're stupid or something like that, which I totally understand. Like, that's exactly what the show is. The show isn't really showing you who America is. It's just pointing out all these bad actors, and it's confirmation bias. It's all it is. I mean, it is funny in its own way, but it's also super depressing because it's literally just poking fun at these people that are actually really bad for all the things that, you know, I feel like decent people stand for. But the people that do think that these people have their best interests in heart, that's not what they're thinking. So when they're watching the show or they're seeing these clips, like, they're just getting offended. And that's what he's always done. Like, that's what Sacha Baron Cohen's always done. He's pressed buttons. He's pushed limits. And I think he's special in that way, and that's why I think, you know, Borat is a really special movie in its own way, but I also totally understand all of the pushback that it's had, and it continues to have. Like, it's problematic, and that's why that's what he's aiming for. Like, he's, it's not like he's just stumbling into this thing, or that he's inadvertently pointing out all these, you know, or saying these terrible things. It's his intention, yeah. But I don't know. It is hard to watch. Like, I was going to watch it because I'm a fan of his, and it's particularly relevant to what's going on. But at the same time, at the end of it, I didn't come out feeling any better about anything. It didn't really solve anything. It doesn't give you any hope.
No. I mean, Nathan, for you at the end of it, you come out of it being like, oh, well, he helped this person, or he didn't help this person, or he helped this person in a really roundabout way. This person's really silly. Like, you come out of Who Is America being like, oh, we're fucked.
Well, yeah,
like,
yeah, that's how it makes you feel. And that's not the case. Like, I feel like a good show would equalize. And I've been making, like, a little playlist of podcasts that I've been listening to recently that try to, like, equalize everything that's going on. You know, just bring everybody back to the point where it's like, okay, yes,
well,
you have these ideas.
Does that mean?
You have these ideas, but that doesn't mean that, you know, one side is completely wrong or the other side's completely wrong, or that people who act this way aren't acting that way because of some legitimate reason. Like, there's humanity at the base of everything, especially politics. And this show just didn't offer any hope. It didn't offer any solutions, and it didn't try to bring anybody together. It just drove the wedge even further into what's going on.
Yeah. And that's what I was thinking,
but it doesn't have like a, I don't think it has a huge impact. You know, I don't even hear anybody talking about the show anymore, and it's only been off for a couple of weeks,
which is a bummer too. It's a huge bummer because it's,
well, I mean, how can you, like, there's just too much going on. You can't talk about anything for more than a couple of days. It's insane. I mean, the Kavanaugh hearings are over, done with. He's on the Supreme Court, and we're already on to the next thing, you know, like Saudi Arabia is the new thing right now. And
Jesus,
nobody's talking about Kavanaugh. So it's the way of the world right now. And that's fine, because I don't know, Who Is America, as funny as some of the segments were, and some of the characters are pretty good, I don't think it really mattered.
Nah. Just, I was just hoping it would be more important than it was.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I thought if anybody could do it, maybe he could. Like, I know that he's, you know, he's a pretty liberal guy. But I thought that he could have done something a little more appealing to a wider base of people. Instead, he was really, the show is just catered to a very small segment of the left that just want to poke and make fun at people. And that's, you know, in a,
I think the global audience also, I mean, like, you have to think about the international audience on this one, because like people who are watching this in England, when I was in England in 2015, it was pre-Trump, you know, like Trump was still campaigning, mm-hmm. and, you know, we were eating dinner with my friend Carly and her folks, and her folks were just like, so Donald Trump. And we, Aaron and I were just like, oh.
Yeah. But is that good? Like, I can see why this would be appealing to people across seas. Like, just looking at this.
No, it's not good, laughing, is what I'm saying.
It's bad.
Well, because that's what they see. That's what they see is like the international audience just sees America as Donald Trump right now. They don't know about, like,
well, I don't know if that's true. I really don't think that's true. I do think that that the world at large thinks that our president is a joke, and I think that they are laughing at us in a way because they're like, okay, this is, you know, America's supposed to be the shining example of democracy, and look who they've elected. Yeah, it's a shit show. It's a disaster, and everybody knows it.
Well, what do you know about England right now? What's the biggest news to come out of England in the past year or two?
Brexit?
Exactly.
Yeah.
But do you know anything about, like, the resistance to Brexit, or, like, the...
It wasn't even supposed to happen.
Right. Well, that's what I mean. Neither was Trump. But,
I know.
Like,
yeah,
But that's the funny part, is it's like, you know, we talk about how America's perceived as Trump, like, and then Brexit, you know, like, that's what I know about England right now. I really don't know much about what's going on in England besides
what I know from
like the biggest news story to come out of there.
You know about Brexit, but you're not laughing at England over Brexit because you know that...
We all had a great laugh about that when it happened, and then Trump happened to America, and then we were just like, oh,
I don't know. I think more people, I think anybody who knows what's going on with Brexit generally knows that this wasn't something that was supposed to happen. It was driven into existence by a couple of bad actors who basically dipped out as soon as it became a thing, and now they're just dealing with it. And that's exactly what happened here. But I think the world at large understands that this is abnormal, and that there were certainly some circumstances that led to the rise of Trumpism, but it's not who America is. And so, yeah, this show is probably funny for them in a way. You know, I'm not talking about the people in the UK. There's a lot of other, you know, there's a lot of other countries that have Netflix or whatever shows this. I guess this is Showtime, so it's probably not anything. But they're watching it on YouTube, and they're downloading it from their torrents. And they're watching it and they're laughing. They're having a good time, just like people here in the States are. But I think at the heart of it, it's like the show doesn't show who America actually is. It's sort of a farce in that way. And I think people do realize that. Like, people laugh at Trump to his face. Like, we saw that a couple weeks ago when world leaders literally
at the UN. Yeah.
Literally laughed at him. And we're all there with him. Like, we're with you. Like, a majority of the United States did not vote for Donald Trump. That's a fact. Like, a majority of the United States did not vote for him. And since the mm-hmm. election, an even larger percentage of people want him out of office. But that's just not how things work. That's not how our democracy works. And maybe down the line that can change, and we can make adjustments to, you know, make it a more fair and direct democracy. But that's not the country that we live in right now. It's just something that we're dealing with, and it sucks. But it happened. And there are a lot of reasons for that, but I think in the fallout, we need to remember that we're not Trump. We don't, like, as a nation, we don't stand behind what Trump is, because we've got a lot of history, and we're going to remember that history after Trump. And Trump is going to be a very, very sad footnote, just like a lot of other moments in our history. Like, Trump is bad, and it's probably, you know, he's maybe one of the worst things to happen to us, but we've done a lot of other bad things too, and I think we've come around to that. And yeah, and
horrendous things. But I mean, that's the thing, is that I like, having, you know, been into Europe a couple times now, you know, it's just, that's their perception of us, is just whatever, you know, they see, you know, in the news. And just like our perception of England is what we see in the news as well too. It's funny, I was thinking about how you were describing Brexit in England and how you likened it to Trump getting elected here. And then I was thinking about how, like, you perfectly, like, almost nailed the monorail episode of Simpsons. Like, that's kind of what a couple bad actors just come in and just set up a monorail system and then dip out last second when everything's going to shit. That's kind of just, the monorail episode is just a really, it's like a little, like, a microcosm of what happens and, like, the worst things that can happen to society.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It doesn't take much. Like, just one idea can catch fire and it just, people can get swept up. I don't know. It's we got some really interesting days coming, especially in like the next month. We're gonna either see a lot of change or things are gonna get worse. So we'll find out.
Yeah. But so here's the thing. I got a new driver's license. I'm officially a New York State resident.
Congrats.
And I registered to vote, but I'm not showing up in the registry yet. I think they said it can take 5 to 7 weeks, and I don't know if I'm gonna be like there.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm gonna be allowed to vote. I'm scared, Jacob.
Oh wait, when was this?
October 2nd is when I registered to vote, essentially. That's when I typed all my information into the machine at the DMV and submitted it all.
Oh, you should be fine. I think the 6th was the cutoff.
I know, but if you look, no, the 12th here in New York was the cutoff.
Oh, you're fine.
I know, but I'm still not showing up in the rolls, and that was 2 weeks ago.
I mean,
like if you go to check your registration status,
registration is super high right now. That's why they have it. That's why they have the cutoff a month ahead of time. Like, you know, in a perfect society, we could sign up to vote the day that we go vote, but
we should be,
we should, but unfortunately our voting system is not set up that way. And
why is it not set up that way? What's like, I guess cause they have to make sure like
the same reasons
you're not a made up person, but like, why don't you just like,
it's the same reasons that gerrymandering happens. Like, it's the same reasons that voter records can be purged if you don't vote.
Yep.
Like, it's a shit show.
Fuck.
On a lighter note, we're alive. I heard a story on a podcast this week about an almost terrible thing that the United States did. I don't remember exactly the term for
this. This is your lighter note?
Yeah. But years ago, this would have been 1961. They were carrying some weapons of the nuclear variety across the United States on a jet, and basically the jet kind of fell apart, and so these bombs fell to Earth. And
we're talking Tybee Island?
No. Did that happen in Tybee?
Yeah, and in is that Georgia or Charleston or like area? It's South Carolina, right? Or is it Georgia?
Oh no, this is North Carolina. Tybee's in Georgia, but this is North Carolina, Goldsboro, 1961. Bombs fell to Earth after a B-52 bomber broke up in midair, and one of the devices behaved precisely as a nuclear weapon was designed to behave in warfare. Its parachute opened, its trigger mechanisms engaged, and only one low voltage switch prevented untold carnage. Basically, there is this one switch, this one safety switch that did not flip to on. And because of that, a 4-megaton bomb didn't explode in North Carolina, spreading fallout as far as Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York City. Like, can you believe it? Could you believe that? Oh my gosh, what a world.
Well, look at the one I just sent you, the Tybee Island one. They still haven't found that bomb.
Really? I think there's still one somewhere in a swamp in North Carolina.
Man, we're so screwed.
Yeah, no
kidding.
What
was this bomb? This bomb was a 12-foot Mark 15, weighed 7,600 pounds. It contains 400 pounds of conventional high explosives and highly enriched uranium. Cool. So that's somewhere off the coast of Georgia.
Holy cow. That's crazy.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Not been found.
Okay, so one of the bombs was recovered in North Carolina. A second bomb was mostly recovered, but one of its cores is likely still buried in up to 200 feet of mud and dirt.
It's probably fine down there, right?
Yeah, but I mean, you know how things come out of swamps. They're perfectly preserved.
Dude, swamp thing. It's going to happen.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
The Swamp Thing?
Yeah. That's a recipe for a Swamp Thing.
remember that? Did you listen to that episode of 99% Invisible where they're talking about how we're going to warn people about radioactive materials 1,000 years from now? Like how we're going to, like, because right now they're burying like radioactive material out in the desert in like caves and everything, and they're marking it with like, you know, signs. But, you know, 1,000 or 2,000 years from now, we not, like, human beings that live on this planet may not speak English anymore. You know, so they're like, okay, what symbol can we use to indicate this is really dangerous? And they're like, okay, what if we draw a picture of like human beings and cats, you know, like dying and turning into skeletons, like a little comic of that. And they're like, well, they may not know what a cat is because cats may be extinct and humans may not be, you know, like the same anymore or whatever. You know, like it may be, I don't even know what they were saying, but yeah, it's just like, it was just really, when you think about the future, like that far out, you know, it's just so weird. It's so weird to think about.
It's,
you know, 2,000 years from now, what the world's going to be like. Because we're only here for like, you know, 80 to 100 years if we're lucky.
Yeah. It's pretty messed up, man. I mean, yeah, like telling the future about all this is going to be nuts. But also, like, right now, we have like minimum wage workers protecting these basically salt mines, these abandoned salt mines that are housing all of our like waste, nuclear waste. It's just underground somewhere. Like I've heard stories about, you know, like people just cutting through fences and loading up a truck with like barrels full of waste and just taking it God knows where. Just nobody knows where it went. It's just gone. it's super scary. Like it's like any superhero movie where plutonium is the goal for the bad guys, and they just pick it up and just wheel it out the door. It's really, really scary.
Did you see that? I saw a news story today that was said that like nobody in the world is buying our recycling anymore.
Really?
Like China stopped buying all our recycled stuff.
Oh my gosh.
So like we just all we have is just a bunch of like a bunch of crap that's just going to landfills that we think we're recycling that's actually just not.
Wait, why isn't China taking our recycling anymore?
Cuz I don't know. Cuz the world, cuz America.
Cuz they've got their own recycling.
It's terrible. Yeah, we're alive, but China won't buy our recycling. They should just be free. Recycled goods should just be free. If any manufacturer in the US needs plastic or whatever for the thing, they should just get free plastic from the recycling centers.
That'd be a good way to spend the government's money, but
I guess, but I don't know anything about business and I don't know how much money it takes to run a recycling plant, so I assume that would have to come from somewhere.
I don't know. Economics is hard, apparently.
I've heard. We just podcasting.
Oh boy.